Women in Music, a chat with a Grammy-winning drummer.
Pat Metheny told me, when you really figure out a way to blend all the things that you do, it's going to be great. And so I feel like finally I've hit the mark on that.
Plus, rediscovering a piano legend lost in Germany's post-war collapse. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. There are no shortage of role models for girls in the music business, unless you want to be a drummer. The drums are usually male turf, with some notable exceptions like Meg White, Sheila E., Mo Tucker, and even Karen Carpenter. This week I got the chance to chat with Terry Lynn Carrington, who has a place beside those drumming greats. She's played with Herbie Hancock, Stan Getz, Dizzy Gillespie, and other jazz greats. Her last album, The Mosaic Project, won a Grammy this year for Best Jazz Vocal Album.
Bella Lawson is on the beautiful Irving Berlin song. I really wanted to take the song and put a new flavor to it. Gretchen Parlato is really one of the premier young jazz vocalists.
There's amazing female musicians on this project. It's an all-woman group.
Every song on the CD I arrange with the voice of the singer in my head.
You've got your fingers in all kinds of musical pies, but I wondered if, even though you've got some success, you've got a Grammy under your belt, you have another nomination under your belt, do you still find yourself running into obstacles that the men you know don't?
I can't really compare myself to other male artists because we're different. Like, they don't do all the things that I do, or I don't do all the things that they do. So it's difficult for me to compare myself with other people. I could say, you know, there's some occasions where I feel like for instance, I was playing at the Village Vanguard and somebody reviewed it for the New York Times. It was basically a good review, but he said that I played too loud. And I don't play as loud as, you know, a lot of the guys that is so well revered. And so that was an instance where I really felt like he was kind of slamming me a little bit, and it felt, you know, relatively, I won't say sexist, but it just felt like he wouldn't have done that to a male drummer of the same stature. Sometimes I imagine that, you know, some guys of similar backgrounds or of similar status in the drum world may make a little more than me. I don't know.
You're on Verve, correct?
No, my first record was on Verve in 1989.
Ah, so that's changed.
Yeah, that was the only record that came out on Verve. See, my last CD, The Mosaic Project, came out on Concord Music. And the next one is Money Jungle. It's called, well, the title of the CD is coming out in February. It's called Money Jungle, Provocative in Blue. And that's coming out on Concord as well. But I had a couple of records out in the, between all those. Two were on a German label called Act, and there was one that came out on E1 Music, which was formerly Koch Records.
And that isn't the way it used to be when you were a successful musician or someone that the company used to see a future with. Artists used to mostly, unless they were unappreciated or badly treated, you'd be with one record label and that's where you'd stay. And I know a lot of musicians that find themselves either dealing with a lot of different labels or going indie.
Right. People don't develop artists, help to develop artists anymore. I mean, it's interesting because I don't think labels were always very good at that anyway. I mean, the people that work at the labels that sign you to a label, most of them are lawyers. You know, the A&R people. You know, that were lawyers turned A&R. And I don't know, I think, you know, producer, they maybe try to help hire the right producers to help direct an artist, but if that combination doesn't work or they don't see a result in sales, they're not into the long haul, the long run. And that's sad, you know. That's definitely changed. Like, my last three records are licensed, so they have a decent release on the label. But, you know, they're licensed, so I have to get it done up front, pay for it, you know, get it all done. And generally, when I license it, I don't get the money back, you know, that I spend on it. But it's kind of the good side is that the rights revert back to me after a certain amount of time.
And that's something actually I've been hearing from a lot of musicians too, where you sort of have to become really well versed in business. It isn't enough to be a really good musician, composer, performer anymore. You need to be a business person.
Well, yeah. I think, you know, musicians should always have known what's going on with their business, because you are a business. I mean, that's what we are. We're developing our own brand, which in the end is a business.
Well, so of all the hats that you wear, which part is the most fun in the music world for you? Is it the process of composing, the performing, the working with other musicians? What's the part that really is you?
Actually, all of it. I like making records. I really like that process. It takes a lot out of me. I mean, I've become a little more obsessive about it the older I've gotten, about all the details. But I really do like the process, and always have. And I like producing records. I'm getting ready to produce Diane Reeb's next record, and I'm looking forward to that. I produced another record of hers about, I don't know. I'll never be able to not go out on the road, because that really feeds me. Even if it's, you know, weekends, long weekends, a few shows here and there, that kind of is a big part of inspiration for me. And I also teach full time at Berklee College of Music, so they keep you current. They help to keep you current.
What changes are you seeing in music when you hear those influences? What's changing?
I think younger artists, like, I've been working a lot with Esperanza Spalding on her last two records, and they're informed differently, you know, 20 years different age. You know, it's different music that you grew up listening to. And it's a, you know, full generation of evolving artistry with, you know, just with what's going on out there in the world. Not just musically, but just in the world in general. And even how technology has grown in 20 years. So they have access, a lot more access to things that I didn't. And I had a lot more access to things that my parents didn't. So you're informed differently, and it just makes, you know, you process things differently, faster. And with all that information, I mean, I think that it just makes your music, I don't want to say more complex, but it has a different dimension. Everything starts to sound global to me, because you know, there's a whole buzzword, you know, global music, but so many artists incorporate so many different influences in their music, and it's becoming a lot more acceptable to do that. And so you can hear, you know, rhythms and sounds that feel, you know, like they might be from Brazil, or they might be from India, or they might be from Africa, or, you know, wherever. And it's kind of not homogenized, but it's all rolled up into, I always lean toward mixing styles, but when my record came out in 89, and then I did a second CD that was supposed to come out a couple of years later, that never came out, and it was because it was not easily labeled. They didn't know what to do with it. They didn't know where to put it, what bin to put it in. And people are used to hearing a CD with the same voice consistently, and I get that, but I thought it was refreshing to hear so many different voices. And, you know, the style blends, too, can be refreshing. But I tried to do it in a way that it felt like one picture and not scattered. And I think that was really embraced by both the industry and the general public. And so I feel like I finally did it, you know, the things that I've been trying to do all these years, it finally kind of came out in a way that other people liked it too. And it's funny because Pat Metheny was one person that told me years and years ago, you know, when you really figure out a way to blend all the things that you do, you know, it's going to be great. And I never forgot that. And so I feel like finally I hit the mark on that. And also, my next CD is Money Jungle, which is a cover of the original Duke Ellington CD, Money Jungle, that was a trio recording featuring Max Roach and Charles Mingus. And my recording is featuring Christian McBride and Gerald Clayton, a great young pianist. And I also added on some songs some other textures, some percussion, some guitar, and some horns. And I also have a couple of guest artists, Clark Terry, the legendary Clark Terry. He's one of the people that played with Duke Ellington. So he's kind of a link between, you know, the Duke of the past and this project, which is arrangements on this Duke Ellington music that does not sound necessarily like Duke Ellington music. So if somebody hears the CD and doesn't really know what it is, they would probably never guess that it's based on themes of Duke Ellington. There's so many great artists that are whose shoulders that we stand on.
Find out more about Terry Lynn Carrington at terrylynncarrington.com. Up next, looking for a lost musical star and making music in an abandoned city lot. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% Archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1208. Imagine a musical artist who plays the biggest American venues, who gets rave reviews wherever she goes, who plays with the biggest stars of her day. Then she disappears. That's the story of Adela Austeroa, a pianist who took America by storm before World War I, then disappeared in the economic chaos of post-war Germany. Lorraine Leno heard her story from his own music teacher, and was determined to rediscover this lost artist.
I had an opportunity to study with a piano teacher by the name of Belle Mayhews. And then a few years later, I studied with her sister, Alma Studness. And these two piano teachers would tell me the most amazing and interesting stories about their teacher that they had studied with when they were young in Berlin. And that was Adela Austeroa. And I was not able to find any books or magazine articles or really any information at all. And even later when the internet became prevalent, there was very little information about her.
When you say that she taught your teachers, I think it's true, but it doesn't give a sense of who this person was. And she was, in her time, basically a rock star, a young woman who studied with Liszt and then came to America and took the country by storm and toured for years.
Yes, and I love the analogy of a rock star because in those days, you know, classical music was very much alive and well, and these performing artists really were treated like our modern-day rock stars. And Austeroa absolutely was a phenomenal sensation. She came to America after she had studied with Franz Liszt and was an immediate success and began to tour throughout the United States. She was the opening soloist when Carnegie Hall was dedicated and Tchaikovsky was invited to conduct, and Austeroa played his piano concerto with him conducting. She was the opening, played in the opening seasons of both the Chicago Symphony and the Minneapolis Symphony. She was just absolutely a phenomenon.
And yet, no one really remembers her. And is that because her performances were not recorded?
Yes, I think there's several reasons, really, and then it still is probably a little bit of a mystery, but yes, she did no recording, and this might be a case of where she was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. In 1905, some recordings were made by a group of Liszt students, and for some reason, she was not part of that group. And so we have tended to probably remember the people who record, and then she missed that opportunity. But also, she went home to Berlin in 1906 when her sister died. And this was unfortunate because she got caught up in the First World War, and that sort of ended her career.
And that was one of the things I found fascinating in your book, Luane, was the description of post-war Germany. We have heard that there was terrible inflation, but you described it so graphically, and the fact that it wiped out so many people's savings, including Adela's.
You're right. That too is something that we don't always know so very much about. I mean, people were literally starving. And it was not because they didn't have food, it was because they couldn't afford the food. And Germany was basically broke at the end of the war. The country was bankrupt. And horrible inflation became rapidly out of control. And the price increases were just astronomical. And people's entire savings were wiped out. You know, it took everything you had to buy a loaf of bread.
She was also a composer. Have you found any of her music?
Yes, yes, I have. She was actually quite a prolific composer, and she played many of her compositions in her own concerts, and she had many compositions published, and this too was a big challenge for women. I think it still is a challenge for women, but definitely in that time, to actually have your compositions published and then to be performing them. Unfortunately, of course, everything is now out of print, but there are copies of many of her compositions still available in, for example, the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and also the State Library in Berlin has copies of her compositions.
So in every life, there's usually some kind of a great love, whether it's what you're doing or it's a person. Would you say that hers was music?
Well, yes, absolutely. I think she was completely committed to it. And there are some wonderful sentences that she wrote in various letters where she speaks about, "My art is holy to me." But, you know, if I could speculate, she had a very fine friend that she met when she was a student of Liszt by the name of Albert Morris Bagby. And I can't go so far as to say that this was a great love, but this was a very deep and very great friendship. And they were friends for the rest of their lives. And it's a very heartwarming part of the story.
Luane Leno is the author of The Lost Story of Adela Austeroa, From a Liszt Student to a Virtuoso. Find out more at adelaaustaroa.com or on his Facebook page, The Untold Story of Adela Austeroa. A group of artists are filling New Orleans' Bywater neighborhood with an odd orchestra. It's a slapdash village of fully interactive musical buildings on a vacant lot, and WRKF's Tegan Wendland went for a visit to see if houses really can make music.
As I walked down a street after a festival in the Bywater on a recent afternoon, I noticed an unusual wooden fence around what seemed like an empty lot. It was painted in pastel figures and intricate cutout patterns, and the door was open. But even more striking were the odd sounds of bells and whistles and creaky floorboards inviting me into a whimsical musical village called Shantytown Music Box. Curator Delaney Martin says the idea for the musical houses just came naturally.
When you say to someone a musical house that you can play, it somehow like just triggers some little thing in their brain and they're like, oh, like, you know, when you've heard of a really good idea, or when someone does something, you're like, I can't believe no one thought of that before.
The property used to be home to a 19th century Creole cottage, which recently fell down and was used to make much of the sculpture park. There's a house with a giant bell-shaped wire dress covered in lace that you can stand inside and shake for a chorus of hundreds of bells and miniature bottles. And the New Orleans artist Quintron built the Sunset Drone, which reacts to weather patterns, cloud cover, rain, and the setting sun through a series of sensory panels, funnels, and a weather vane. Co-curator Theo Eliezer describes it as a love letter to New Orleans.
Part of the experience of living here is of constantly being surrounded by odd noises, creaks and clatters and groans that just kind of exist alongside of us.
Visitor Diane D'Anthony recently sat on an amped rocking chair, which hangs from the biggest structure on the property, the River House, and plucked at old guitar strings as each of the chair's creaky movements played through the radio mounted to the wall. It was her first time visiting, and she's not a musician, but she says the experience was moving.
It's odd, it's captivating, and it does something that kind of more orchestrated music just doesn't. I cannot explain how it just touches something in me. I'm struck by this. I want to stay.
The Music Box has hosted several concerts in recent months featuring well-known musicians. For a show in November, saxophonist Dickie Landry of Lafayette played an adapted computerized version of the gamelan, which is based on an Indonesian xylophone. He says the instrument is totally unlike anything he's played before.
Life is a challenge. Music is a challenge. If it's not a challenge, I'm bored.
Not only were the instruments unusual, they brought together a diverse group of performers, including hip-hop producer Manny Fresh and New Orleans musician James Singleton. Landry says there's something about the experimental instruments that really makes that possible.
This is like rare. This is rare of the rare, you know, like get musicians of all different genres. You know, you got a rapper, you got a jazz bass player, you got a rock drummer.
Travis Cleaver attended a recent show and says it was unlike any concert he's ever been to. He says he was surprised by
the absurdity of the whole thing. They use all kinds of strange repurposed materials to create instruments that you've never seen before, that probably have never existed before.
Volunteer Michael Glemboski says he loves how it draws the community together, even though not many people know about it.
We had an overwhelming amount of people for the first show. A lot of people got turned away. Another big thing is during the day when the public can come out here and the kids are in here exploring. They've discovered sounds that they make that even some of the artists weren't intending them for them to make.
Martin says that's the whole point. She wants to recognize the city's musical history while giving new life to discarded materials and bringing the community together. Plus, it's really appealing. All of us have experienced how a house makes noise, whether it's the creaking floorboards or a staircase.
I asked some kids who came through here, what sounds does your houses make? And someone said, oh, my mom blow drying her hair, that's a house sound. And I just think people can like kind of put the concept together.
But the Music Box won't be there for long. The Village is a prototype for a permanent installation designed by the Brooklyn-based artist Swoon, known for her intricate cutout paper wall murals and handmade sculptural boats. Dithy Rambolino will be an intricate, full scale up to code house constructed of salvaged materials.
We can make these instruments in a workshop or a studio, but unless you have hundreds of people coming through and messing around with them and playing them, you won't really know what it's going to sound like or how it's going to hold up.
Martin says they plan to tear the whole Music Box down in the next few months to make way for Dithy Rambolino. It will be open to the public for 3 months before it becomes the permanent headquarters for the arts organization New Orleans Airlift, run by Martin and Jay Pennington, who owns the property. To see photos, visit WRKF.org. I'm Tegan Wendland.
That story comes to us courtesy affiliate WRKF in New Orleans. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again, or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, the Women's Perspective.